campaign has a hometown problem. The donors and volunteers who have lost interest after launching his run for the White House 4 years ago. Stephen R. Strahler and Paul Marion wrote in September 2011 in ChicagoBusiness.com. And among Jewish contributors, a bulwark of his local donor base, some have been turned off by Mr. Obama's call for Israel to give up part of its territory. The assumption on the part of the Obama administration is that because Jews are liberals, they simply will not vote for Republicans, said the Hollywood billionaire Chaim Saban, one of the Democratic Party's mega-donors. Obama can invite the 10 most prolific Jewish campaign bundlers to the White House for a discussion and give a wonderful speech, and he'll think that this may resolve all his problems with American Jews. And it may. Or it may not. The idea that we saw a black president in our lifetime is wonderful, said New York City's former mayor Ed Koch. It conveyed to us that this country has come such a long way. But I never fully accepted that Obama didn't hear his minister, Jeremiah Wright, make those awful anti-Semitic statements over 20 years. I wanted to believe him. I willed myself to believe him. What he has done to break that trust. Like Humpty Dumpty, once you break it, you can't put it together again. The Jewish problem with Obama could be traced back to his first full day on the job. On January 21, 2009, he summoned his national security team to the Oval Office and laid out a tough new policy toward Israel. Obama said that in order to make good on his campaign promise to extricate 200,000 American troops from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the U.S. had to create a grand coalition of moderate Muslim states and Israel to isolate Iran, which had made no secret of its ambition to become the nuclear hegemon in the Middle East. The only way to accomplish that goal, the president stated, was to eliminate the poisonous effect of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which provided Iran with an excuse to stir up trouble. Thus, it was a vital national interest of the United States to stop Israel from building settlements in the occupied West Bank and housing in East Jerusalem, and force the Jewish state to resolve the Palestinian problem. Previous White Houses had made similar noises about bringing peace to the Middle East, and at first, Jewish leaders didn't pay much attention to leaks emanating from the new administration about a fundamental change in American policy. However, a clue to the president's true intentions came in March 2009, when Abe Foxman, the national director of the Anti-Defamation League, met with the president's then chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel. "This is Israel's moment of truth," Emanuel told Foxman. "This president is determined to make peace between Israel and the Arabs." To many Jews, it seemed highly improbable that a brand new president would choose to alienate Israel, America's oldest and most loyal ally in the Middle East. But then, in July 2009, when President Obama made his first overseas trip, he chose to visit three Muslim countries, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. During a landmark speech in Cairo, he announced his intention to seek a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world. Understandably enough, American Jews were annoyed that the president had failed to include Israel in his Mideast swing. But what rankled them even more was that Obama seemed to adopt the Arab narrative to explain the existence of Israel, namely, that Israel was created because of past Jewish suffering in Europe, particularly during the Holocaust. Nowhere in his Cairo speech did Obama mention the fact that Jews had a 3,000-year history in the Promised Land. Things went from bad to worse when the president called a meeting of Jewish leaders in July. 14 major Jewish organizations were represented at this meeting, including J Street, the newly formed left-of-center Jewish lobby. J Street is on the same wavelength as the Peace Now movement in Israel, which believes that continued occupation of the West Bank harms Israel, both economically and politically, and damages the values and fabric of the Jewish state. Rabbi Eric Jaffe, a reform Jewish leader, asked the president why he had singled out Israel for public criticism. "Look," said the thin-skinned president, clearly annoyed by the question, "we have some very smart people on this. Don't think that we don't understand the nuances of the settlement issue. We do. Rahm Emanuel understands the politics there, and he explains them to me." Some of the Jews attending the meeting were shocked to hear the president admit that he had to be educated about Israel's concerns. "I agree with your goal to bring peace to the Middle East," the Anti-Defamation League's Abe Foxman told the president. "But the perception is that you're beating up only on Israel, and not on the Arabs. If you want Israel to take risks for peace, the best way is to make Israel feel that its staunch friend, America, is behind it." "You are absolutely wrong," the president replied. "For the past 8 years under the Bush administration, Israel had a friend in the United States, and it didn't make peace." I came away from the meeting convinced that Obama has introduced a new and dangerous strategy and that it's revealing itself in steps, Foxman told me. "Unlike other administrations, this one is applying linkage in the Middle East. It's saying that if you resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Messiah will come and the lions will lie down with the lambs. All the president's advisors on the Middle East, starting with George Mitchell, believe in linkage, and they're telling the president you have to prove to the Arab Muslim world that you are different than previous presidents and you can separate yourself from Israel, distance yourself from the settlements issue. After all, settlements are something that American Jews don't like anyway, so it's a win-win proposition." The Anti-Defamation League was the first mainstream Jewish organization to openly criticize the president on the issue of the Middle East. Soon, other groups began to join the chorus. However, the great majority of Jews still remained steadfast behind Obama and his administration's liberal agenda. They simply were not ready to criticize their country's first African-American president, a man in whom they had invested so many of their own hopes and dreams. On March 10, 2010, a relatively low-level official in the Israeli Interior Ministry issued a permit for 1,600 new housing units for Israelis in the Ramat Shlomo section of East Jerusalem. The ill-timed announcement came on the very day Vice President Joe Biden arrived in Israel to kickstart a round of indirect peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu immediately apologized to Biden, who accepted his expression of regret. But Mahmoud Abbas, president of the Palestinian National Authority on the West Bank, called off the proximity talks. The next day, at the regularly scheduled weekly breakfast meeting between the president and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Obama made his feelings clear. He was livid. As he saw it, the Israelis had purposely humiliated his vice president and tried to sabotage his peace plan. It was a personal affront, and he wouldn't stand for such treatment. He instructed Hillary to call Netanyahu and read him the riot act. The following day, during a 43-minute harangue, Hillary delivered a set of ultimatums to Netanyahu, prefacing each remark with the phrase, "I have been instructed to tell you." Hillary demanded that Israel release a substantial number of Palestinian prisoners as a token of goodwill, lift its siege of Gaza, suspend all settlements in the West Bank and Jerusalem, accept that a symbolic number of Palestinians be given the right of return to Israel under a future peace treaty, and agree to place the question of the status of Jerusalem at the top of the peace talks agenda. "If you refuse these demands," Hillary told Netanyahu, "the United States government will conclude that we no longer share the same interests." Netanyahu bit his tongue and remained noncommittal about the American demands, though he did eventually agree to ease the blockade of Gaza. That same Friday, the Israeli ambassador to Washington, Michael Oren, was summoned to the State Department and given a severe dressing down. Someone who saw Oren that night at a party described him as shaken. And things did not end there. 10 days later, Netanyahu was invited to the White House, where he was treated to further browbeating and humiliation. Photographers were banned from recording the visit. At one point, President Obama left Netanyahu to have dinner with Michelle and their daughters, Malia and Sasha. "I'm going upstairs," the president told Netanyahu. "Call me when you're ready to talk substance." Netanyahu and his entourage were then left to cool their heels in the Roosevelt Room. At one point, the Israeli delegation asked for food and something to drink. They were served non-kosher food, which some of them couldn't eat. The White House seemed strangely indifferent to the feelings of resentment that its treatment of Netanyahu aroused in the Jewish community. For shortly after Netanyahu returned to Israel, President Obama risked provoking even greater Jewish outrage by insinuating that American troops were dying in Iraq and Afghanistan because Israel refused to agree to peace with the Palestinians. "The Israeli-Arab conflict is costing us significantly in terms of both blood and treasure," the president said. A perception began to spread throughout the Jewish community that the Obama administration was not only outwardly hostile to Israel, but perhaps, without even knowing it, hostile to Jews as well. This thesis was forcefully argued by Jonathan Kellerman, best-selling novelist and professor of clinical pediatrics and psychology at the University of Southern California's Keck School of Medicine. "My personal opinion is that the bifurcation of Israel and Judaism is structurally fallacious. The land of Israel is an essential ingredient of Judaism practiced fully. Thus, it is impossible to be anti-Israel and not be anti-Jewish. And in fact, the war being waged against Israel by the Muslim world is, at the core, a religious dispute. Radical Islamists no longer talk about Zionists. They come right out and broadcast their goal of eradicating worldwide Jewry." The impression of an anti-Jewish bias at the highest echelons of the Obama administration, though unproved, was given added force in April when James Jones, the retired Marine Corps four-star general who then served as President Obama's national security advisor, delivered a speech at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He opened his remarks with a joke that was widely interpreted by many Jews as being flagrantly anti-Semitic. Said Jones, "I'd just like to tell you a story that I think is true. It happened recently in southern Afghanistan. A member of the Taliban was separated from his fighting party and wandered around for a few days in the desert, lost, out of food, no water. And he looked on the horizon, and he saw what looked like a little shack, and he walked toward that shack. And as he got to it, it turned out it was a little store owned by a Jewish merchant. And the Taliban warrior went up to him and said, 'I need water, give me some water.' And the merchant said, 'I'm sorry, I don't have any water, but would you like a tie? We have a nice sale on ties today.' Whereupon the Taliban erupted into a stream of language that I can't repeat, but about Israel, about Jewish people, about the man himself, about his family, and just said, 'I need water. You try to sell me ties. You people don't get it.' And impassively the merchant stood there until the Taliban was through with his diatribe and said, 'Well, I'm sorry that I don't have water for you, and I forgive you for all the insults you've levied against me, my family, my country. But I will help you out. If you go over that hill and walk about 2 miles, there is a restaurant there, and they have all the water you need.' And the Taliban, instead of saying thanks, still muttering under his breath, disappears over the hill, only to come back an hour later. And walking up to the merchant says, 'Your brother tells me you need a tie to get into the restaurant.'" At a certain point, many Jews began to wonder if there was something more behind the Obama administration's confrontational approach toward Israel than a simple difference of policy. As a result, they began to take a second look at Obama's past for clues to his present behavior. In particular, they were curious how Chicago's bare-knuckle politics had shaped Obama's outlook. "Maybe Jews and blacks were once the closest of allies in Chicago," said Joseph Aaron, the liberal editor of The Jewish News, Chicago's largest Jewish newspaper. "But in the years that Obama was being shaped, A lot of young blacks, especially in the South Side neighborhood where Obama lived, harbored animosity toward Jews and Israel. Two central issues divided blacks and Jews in those years, Aaron continued. Blacks saw affirmative action as a way to overcome prejudice, while many Jews saw it as a quota system designed to keep them out. It was also a time when Israel, snubbed by many nations, especially in black Africa, chose to forge close ties with the apartheid regime in South Africa. That included selling Israeli arms to South Africa. We never realized the degree to which those links to South Africa hurt black sensitivities. Add it all up, and you don't come up with an anti-Semitic Obama. That is not who Obama is. What you do come up with is someone who doesn't really understand our attachment to Israel, or Israel's importance to Jews as a people. A president who doesn't have a gut love for Israel, like some of his predecessors, but someone who understands the Palestinian position better than any president we've had. Someone with no natural affinity for Jews or Israel, and someone who approaches the Middle East, as he does most everything else, dispassionately, and with a burning desire to fix the problem. As the New York Times wrote about Obama in the months leading up to the 2008 Democratic National Convention, the secret of his transformation from a newcomer to the brink of claiming the Democratic presidential nomination can be described as the politics of maximum unity. Obama moved from his leftist base to more centrist circles. He forged early alliances with the good government reform crowd, only to be embraced later by the city's all-powerful Democratic bosses. He railed against pork barrel politics, but engaged in it when needed. And he empathized with the views of the Palestinian friends before adroitly courting the city's politically potent Jewish community. That courtship brought Obama the support of some of the wealthiest Jews in Chicago. They included Penny Pritzker, of the Hyatt Hotel chain family, Betty Lou Saltzman, daughter of the late real estate baron Philip Klutznick, former Congressman Abner Mikva, Lester Crown, a billionaire benefactor of Jewish charities, and Lee Rosenberg, a media and entertainment mogul, who accompanied Obama on his 2004 senatorial election campaign visit to Israel, where Obama placed a handwritten prayer for peace in the cracks of Jerusalem's Western Wall. Few of these early Jewish sponsors have since publicly criticized the president for his tough line on Israel. But at least three of his Chicago backers, Penny Pritzker, Lester Crown, and Lee Rosenberg, the president of the powerful pro-Israel lobby AIPAC, America-Israel Public Affairs Committee, expressed their distress in private conversations with Obama. Some people blamed Obama's Jewish problem on his advisors, including his former chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, whose Israeli father was a member of the Irgun Underground during Israel's struggle for independence, and Valerie Jarrett, who made no secret of her close ties to the Jordanian royal family. But veteran journalist Richard Z. Chesnoff, who has had more than 40 years of experience reporting from the Middle East, and who's done extensive research on Obama's management style, didn't agree with that assessment. In my opinion, says Chesnoff, Obama's problem in dealing with the Arab-Israeli conundrum doesn't come from the advice he's getting from his advisors, but rather from his one-man style and his inflated view of his own leadership talents. Obama believes that no matter what the odds against it, he can bring everyone together, kumbaya style, so that we can solve hitherto insoluble problems. Perhaps even more egregiously, he seems to have an exaggerated sense of his own depth of understanding of the Middle East, which is simply not borne out by his background or experience. The problem is naivete in the Obama administration, added Robert Lieber, professor of government at Georgetown University. The president came into office with the assumption that the Israel-Palestinian conflict is by far the most central urgent problem in the region, which it is not, and that it is the key that unlocks everything else in the region. And he and his advisors believed the Israeli-Palestinian situation was ripe for progress, which it absolutely isn't. By the end of March 2010, Most of the organized Jewish community was in full cry against the Obama administration's treatment of Israel. However, the voice of New York's senior senator, Chuck Schumer, one of the most influential elected Jewish officials in Washington, was conspicuously silent. That gave Ed Koch, an incurable gadfly, the opportunity to taunt his frenemy Schumer in his blog, Ed Koch Commentary. "Chuck Schumer resented my blog," Koch told me. "He called me and said, 'How can you say this? I'm a protector of Israel.' And I said, 'Chuck, you're not speaking out.' And he said, 'I'm doing it behind the scenes.' He was upset because there was a piece quoting me as saying, 'It's obvious Chuck wants to be the majority leader in the Senate if Harry Reid leaves, and Chuck doesn't want to criticize the president and diminish his chances.'" Throughout April 2010, the pressure on Schumer continued to mount. Finally, when P.J. Crowley, the State Department spokesman, announced at a press conference that the relationship of Israel and the United States depended on the pace of peace negotiations, Schumer could no longer hold his tongue. "This is terrible," Schumer said. "That is a dagger, because the relationship is much deeper than the disagreements on negotiations, and most Americans, Democrat, Republican, Jew, non-Jew, would feel that. So I called up Rahm Emanuel and I called up the White House and I said, 'If you don't retract that statement, you're going to hear me publicly blast you on this.' You have to show Israel that it's not going to be forced to do things it doesn't want to do and can't do," Schumer continued. "At the same time, you have to show the Palestinians that they are not going to get their way by just sitting back and not giving in, and not recognizing that there is a state of Israel. And right now, there's a battle going on inside the administration. One side agrees with us, one side doesn't, and we're pushing hard to make sure the right side wins, and if not, we'll have to take it to the next step." After Schumer's j'accuse, it became clear that the inexperienced Obama had once again overplayed his hand. In part, the president had allowed himself to be influenced by the growing volume of anti-Israel anger coming from the left wing of the Democratic Party, especially from radical students on campuses, where calls for the delegitimization of the Jewish state were almost de rigueur. In part two, the president probably placed too much weight on recent sociological studies that indicated a shift in American Jewish attitudes on Israel. In May 2010, under mounting pressure, the president agreed to meet with Jewish members of the Democratic caucuses in the House and Senate. 37 of the 43 Jews in Congress met with Obama, the largest such gathering of Jewish lawmakers ever held in the White House. One of the attendees, who took notes during the meeting, made them available to the author of this book. Here is a transcript of what Obama said to the Jewish congressmen and women. "Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad and Abu Mazen, Palestinian Liberation Organization Chairman Mahmoud Abbas, are as moderate as we are going to get. My policy on settlements is no different than George Bush's, but I won't wink or nod. You want me to be explicit on Iran, but as the guy with his finger on the button, I am not going to say anything. When I say an Iranian nuclear weapon is unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Bibi's speech at AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee on Jerusalem, was belligerent. I'm pro-Israel, not pro-Shas, an ultra-Orthodox religious political party in Israel that opposes any freeze on Israeli settlements in the West Bank. My job is to protect the national security of the United States. I fundamentally believe the key to the Middle East is being an even-handed broker. I'm pained that people don't think I support Israel. I take responsibility for stubbing my toe on messaging. My views are distorted. I feel close to the Jewish community. I wouldn't be here without many of you. There are legitimate differences between the United States and Israel, and between me and Prime Minister Netanyahu. I spent more time with him than any other foreign leader. Everyone knows two states is the only solution. I can't impose a settlement, but I may outline a solution for the parties. Our public disagreement with Israel gives us credibility with the Arab states, and compels them to act. What most disturbed the Jewish members of Congress was that last comment by Obama, namely, that by haranguing Israel in public and portraying it as a villain in the peace process, Washington gained credibility and influence with the Arabs. No one in the room believed that to be true. Quite the opposite, they believed that the bad blood between the Obama administration and Israel encouraged the Arabs to be more, not less, intransigent. Indeed, after the meeting, Representative Jan Schakowsky of Illinois, one of Obama's most loyal backers, shook her head and admitted, "He doesn't understand that ally-to-ally differences should not be aired in public. He's isolating Israel and putting Israel in a weakened position." When word of Obama's views inevitably spread beyond the Capitol Beltway, it sent shockwaves through the Jewish community. Said one prominent Jewish leader, "You can draw a straight line between that meeting and Obama's fundraising problems with Jews today." The majority of today's American Jews don't see themselves as outsiders or victims anymore, said Benjamin Jilkovsky, the publisher and editor of the widely read internet magazine JewishWorldReview.com. That's positive, but that feeling of equality has also produced a communal negative. The fear that came with being an outsider also gave most Jews, even non-religious ones, a cohesive sense of responsibility regarding their Jewish identity in general, and Israel in particular. "That's changed," Jilkovsky continued. "I'm no senior citizen, but today's generation didn't witness the Holocaust. They don't understand what was entailed in the birth of Israel. They don't even remember the real threats of the 1967 Six-Day War. They probably never read the novel Exodus. The majority of young American Jews think that somehow Israel will always be there. They don't understand that when your enemies say they want to destroy you, they mean it." Most of all, what Obama didn't count on was that, for all the changes taking place among younger, progressive Jews, Jerusalem remained a third rail in American politics. The person who seemed to understand that better than anyone else was Elie Wiesel, the Nobel laureate and Holocaust survivor, who took out full-page ads in April 2010 in major American newspapers to express his views on the city of Jerusalem. "For me, the Jew that I am, Jerusalem is above politics," Wiesel wrote. "It is mentioned more than 600 times in Scripture, and not a single time in the Koran. Its presence in Jewish history is overwhelming. There is no more moving prayer in Jewish history than the one expressing our yearning to return to Jerusalem. To many theologians, it is Jewish history. To many poets, a source of inspiration. It belongs to the Jewish people and is much more than a city. It is what binds one Jew to another in a way that remains hard to explain. When a Jew visits Jerusalem for the first time, it is not the first time. It is a homecoming." I interviewed Wiesel following a private lunch that he had in early May with President Obama at the White House. "The invitation came before my public statements on Jerusalem," Wiesel said. "It was a very good lunch, no small talk. Everything was substance. I understood his position. We didn't agree on everything. The president wanted to know why Bibi, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, didn't fire the minister who made that Jerusalem announcement about expanding Jewish housing during Vice President Joe Biden's visit. I said he would have had to go to his party and say, 'Give me anyone else.' But he didn't, and then there was a chain reaction. Most of the problems between America and Israel remain, but the intensity on both sides and the recriminations are gone," Wiesel added. During our lunch, it was clear that the president does at least know that Jerusalem is the center of Jewish history, and he knows you can't ignore 3,000 to 4,000 years of history. "I believe the only way to attain peace is to put Jerusalem at the end of the negotiations, not at the beginning." Since the shellacking it suffered in the 2010 midterm elections, the Obama administration has softened some of its more controversial Mideast policy initiatives. For instance, on Jerusalem, The White House conceded that the question of the city's status should come at the end of negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians, as Elie Wiesel desired, rather than at the beginning, as the president originally wanted. Along with this apparent U-turn in substance, the White House launched a charm offensive to win back the allegiance of the Jewish community. The president set the tone. He sent a personal letter to Alan Solow, the former chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, in which he reasserted his support for Israel's security. And he followed that up with a warm message of greeting on the occasion of Israel's 62nd Independence Day. Meanwhile, pro-Obama rabbis from local communities all over America were invited to the White House for schmooze fests with Rahm Emanuel, Daniel Shapiro, the deputy national security advisor who dealt with the Middle East, and Dennis Ross, the White House's top Iran policy official. The three men told the Democratic rabbis that the administration has three priorities in the Middle East, Caroline Glick reported in the Jerusalem Post. First, Obama seeks to isolate Iran. Second, he seeks to significantly reduce the U.S. military presence in the Middle East, particularly in Iraq. And third, he seeks to resolve the Palestinian conflict with Israel. As part of its PR campaign, the White House had David Axelrod do a limited mea culpa. With some of the leadership of the Jewish community, there's been some bumps in the road over the past 15 months, Axelrod admitted in a phone conversation with the author of this book. Some of those bumps resulted purely from a lack of communication on our part. I don't think we've done as good a job as we could have in our communications with the Jewish community during the first year or so of the administration. We've had a sustained and vigorous round of communications in the last few months, and I think that's been helpful. The crowning moment in Washington's charm offensive came in July 2010, when Prime Minister Netanyahu returned to Washington, and this time was given the red carpet treatment. He was honored with a working lunch in the cabinet room and a photo op with Obama in the Oval Office. But things didn't work out as the White House had planned. As the TV cameras recorded the scene, Netanyahu wagged his finger under Obama's nose and lectured the president on the Middle East. Obama sat there, saying nothing and looking like a weak, immature schoolboy. But neither the White House's charm offensive nor the minor adjustments it has made in its policies can obscure an irrefutable fact. The changes are tactical and tonal, not substantive. The goal is still the same: to conclude successful peace talks by applying pressure on Israel. In my view, the Obama administration has not pulled back from its desire to ingratiate itself with the Arab world, said Kenneth J. Balkin, chairman of the American-Israel Friendship League. Footnote. According to CNN, the White House's efforts to ingratiate itself with the Arab world have not worked. Opinion polls indicate that the favorability rating of the United States in much of the Arab world is lower under President Obama than it was during the Bush administration. Yes, they've pulled back from saying that Israel's conduct endangers the lives of American soldiers in the Middle East, but most of its charm offensive was aimed at damage control. Domestic politics surely played a role in the president's calculations vis-a-vis the American Jewish community. But Obama was also influenced by his major foreign policy conundrum: how to contain a resurgent Iran. In pursuit of that goal, Obama expected Israel to strike a peace accord with the Palestinians and their Arab allies, no matter how real or unreal that expectation might be. Obama and his people believe the Palestinian leadership is genuinely ready for historic compromise, says David Horowitz, the London-born former editor of the Jerusalem Post. The unfortunate consensus in Israel, and not just the hawks, is that while we wish the Arabs were ready, they aren't. To our great sorrow and to our great cost, We are not convinced that even the relative moderates, like Abbas and Prime Minister Fayyad, have internalized the idea that Jews have historic rights here, too. Indeed, in the days just before a new round of peace talks began, Palestinian leaders went out of their way to declare that while they might be prepared to negotiate with Israel, they would never recognize the legitimacy of a Jewish state in the Middle East. In other words, nothing fundamental has changed in the Arab approach to Israel's right to exist since the creation of the State of Israel 62 years ago. In March 2012, with the threat of a nuclear war with Iran hanging over both Israel and the United States, Netanyahu was invited back to the White House for yet another face-to-face with Obama. It was, said Jonathan S. Tobin on the Contentions website of Commentary Magazine in February 2012, impossible to ignore the political implications of this summit. With evidence mounting that Obama and the Democrats have been bleeding Jewish support in the last year, the visit took the president's charm offensive, aimed at convincing the Jewish community he is Israel's best friend, to a new level. Netanyahu had good reason to play along with Obama's pretense, as he may have to go on dealing with him until January 2017. But the question remained whether the two men could sufficiently paper over their personal hostility and policy differences in order for the visit to have the effect the president's political handlers are aiming for. Chapter 16. All in the Family. This president runs from race like a black man runs from a cop. Michael Eric Dyson, an African-American professor of sociology at Georgetown University. During the months I spent researching and writing this book, I was frequently asked the same question. What surprised you the most about Barack Obama? My answer was always the same. I said that I was surprised by how badly America's first black president had bungled his relations with black America. Early on in his presidency, wrote Randall Kennedy in The Persistence of the Color Line, Obama was pressed by some activists and politicians to offer race-specific policies to address the disproportionately high rates of unemployment that have long plagued black and other racial minority communities. He steadfastly refused to do so. I can't pass laws that say I'm just helping black folks, he responded when asked about Congressional Black Caucus criticism of his employment policy. I'm the President of the United States. What I can do is make sure that I am passing laws that help all people, particularly those that are most vulnerable and most in need. That, in turn, is going to help lift up the African-American community. Here Obama was engaging in the old trick of creating a straw man to knock down, Kennedy continued. The CBC was not requesting policy aimed at just helping black folks. It was requesting policy that would be intended to assist Americans as a whole, but particularly those who are most vulnerable in economic downturns. Despite Obama's failed economic policies, grievances between black leaders and the black president were kept under wraps for quite some time. White Americans were hardly aware of the family squabble. But those grievances finally surfaced in a dramatic way in the summer of 2010, when Shirley Sherrod, the black Georgia State Director of Rural Development for the United States Department of Agriculture, was forced to resign under orders from the Obama White House. During a speech that Sherrod had delivered at a meeting of the NAACP, she related her experience with a white farmer who came to her for help. Andrew Breitbart, the late conservative blogger, got hold of the tape of Sherrod's speech and, through selective editing, made it sound as though Sherrod had refused to help the farmer because he was white. In Breitbart's telling, Sherrod was a black racist. However, when the complete tape of Sherrod's speech was released, it became clear that she was nothing of the sort. In fact, she had worked hard to save the white farmer's land. By firing Sherrod without looking into the matter more carefully, Obama once again revealed himself to be politically inept. Unknowingly, he had picked a fight with the wrong black person, for not only was Shirley Sherrod falsely maligned by the White House, but it turned out that her husband, Charles Surratt, had played a significant role in the 1960s civil rights movement. Charles Surratt had been a freedom writer, along with John Lewis, a prominent member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and a longtime Georgia congressman. As might be expected, the African-American political elite quickly came to the defense of the Surratts. "I've known these two individuals, the husband for more than 50 years and the wife for at least 35, 40, and there's not a racist hair on their heads or any place else on their bodies," Congressman Lewis said. "I don't think a single black person was consulted before Shirley Surratt was fired. I mean, come on," said Congressman James Clyburn of South Carolina, who had ditched Hillary Clinton to support Obama in the 2008 Democratic primary campaign. "The president is getting hurt real bad. He needs some black people around him. Some people over there in the White House are not sensitive at all about race. They really feel that the extent to which he allows himself to talk about race would tend to pigeonhole him or cost him support, when a lot of people saw his election as a way to get the issue behind us. I don't think people elected him to disengage on race, just the opposite." Eleanor Holmes Norton, the representative from the District of Columbia, concurred. "The president needs some advisors or friends who have a greater sense of the pulse of the African-American community, or who at least have been around the mulberry bush." Never one to graciously admit his mistakes, Obama finally phoned Shirley Surratt and spoke to her for a grudging 7 minutes. Obama said he felt that the incident had been blown way out of proportion, and he refused to apologize personally for the national humiliation Surratt had suffered. When he offered Surratt another job in the Agriculture Department, she politely declined. In the wake of the Surratt incident, Maureen Dowd, usually a liberal voice on the op-ed page of the New York Times, unleashed a blistering rebuke of Obama. "The Obama White House is too white," wrote Dowd. "It has Barack Obama, raised in the Hawaiian hood in Indonesia, and Valerie Jarrett, who spent her early years in Iran. But unlike Bill Clinton, who never needed help fathoming Southern black culture, Obama lacks advisors who are descended from the Central African American experience, ones who understand the slave thing, as a top black Democrat dryly puts it. The president shouldn't give Surratt her old job back. He should give her a new job, director of black outreach. This White House needs one." The Surratt case was a turning point in relations between Obama and the black leadership. No longer were blacks willing to bite their tongues when speaking about the black president. By the summer of 2011, the Congressional Black Caucus was openly warning Obama that black voters were frustrated by his administration's unwillingness to address black joblessness, which was more than double the national average, and which rose as high as 40% in urban centers like Chicago and Detroit. The message was clear. Although Obama would probably still get more than 90% of the African-American vote in 2012, he couldn't count on the kind of black turnout he had generated in 2008 to offset the white vote in swing states. "I'm frustrated with the president. I'm frustrated with the Senate. I'm frustrated with the House," Representative Emanuel Cleaver II, a Missouri Democrat and chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, said in an interview with the Wall Street Journal. "The president and his White House team are trying to minimize the discussion of race as it relates to job creation." Emanuel Cleaver's complaint was echoed by Maxine Waters, a former chairman of the caucus. "The worry should be that are black people going to be enthusiastic about getting to the polls, or are they not going to be enthusiastic?" Obama compounded his problem with African Americans in August 2011, when he set off on a 3-day bus tour through the Midwest to talk about his push to create jobs. With his approval ratings at an all-time low of 39%, Obama campaigned before all-white audiences in Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois. This set off a chorus of criticism from black leaders who wanted to know why the president had avoided African-American communities. Stung by all this criticism, Obama appeared before the Congressional Black Caucus in September 2011 and gave a no-holds-barred speech chastising his critics. He told the attendees at the gathering to take off your bedroom slippers, put on your marching shoes, and stop complaining, stop grumbling, stop crying. In response, Maxine Waters deftly put the president in his place. "I've never owned a pair of bedroom slippers," she said. If relations between Obama and black politicians were touchy, they were downright contentious with black businessmen. I spoke with Harry C. Alford, the president and CEO of the National Black Chamber of Commerce, which represents the nearly 2 million black businesses in the United States. "When Obama became president, we were all happy about the symbolism, America's first black president," Alford told me. "We didn't really care about his position or views on anything. We just wanted a black president no matter what. We should have been more careful, as his views on small business, especially black business, are counter to ours. His view of business is that it should be a few major corporations which are totally unionized and working with the government, which should also be massive and reaching every level of American society," Alford continued. "Thus, his first executive order was the reinstatement of project labor agreements in government contracting. PLAs give labor unions an exclusive option in construction jobs. All participating firms must use union labor, or at least, pay union wages and abide by union rules. This activity, in effect, discriminates against blacks, Hispanics, and women per se, as trade unions deliberately underemploy them. President George W. Bush eliminated PLAs from federal contracting, and his main reason was unions discriminate against small business, women, and minorities. So here we are with the first black president who deliberately discriminates against small business, women, and minorities. How ironic." As he headed into his fourth year in office and began to gear up for his re-election campaign, Obama was forced to face an uncomfortable fact. He was profoundly unpopular with black leaders, who found him cold and distant, an inauthentic brother. If he hoped to generate a large black voter turnout in 2012, something had to be done to counter this growing disenchantment. He had to rally his base. Suddenly, I started hearing from prominent blacks whose phone calls and emails to the White House had gone unanswered for 3 years. "I wanted you to know that I finally got an invitation to the White House. I was asked to attend the White House Christmas party," one of Obama's severest black critics told me. Others confirmed that the White House had undertaken a full-court press to win black approval. In January 2012, the president turned up at Harlem's Apollo Theater, the mecca of African-American culture, where he broke into the opening of Al Green's recording of "Let's Stay Together." A month later, he hosted a tribute to the blues at the White House and joined bluesmen B.B. King and Buddy Guy for the first few lines of "Sweet Home Chicago." "It makes the president more likable because it's humanizing," said Mark McKinnon, a Republican political strategist and a one-time Nashville songwriter. "Just the fact that he tried to sing in public was a single. That he sang well was a double. That he didn't sing America the Beautiful was a triple. That he sang Al Green was a home run. Not saying that he could win American Idol, but he's got some decent pipes. History will judge his presidency, but it's probably not a stretch to say he may be the best crooner to occupy the White House." Part 4. The Obama Doctrine. The United States under Barack Obama is less assertive, less dominant, less power-minded, less focused on the American people's particular interests, and less concerned about preserving U.S. freedom of action. Douglas J. Feith and Seth Cropsey, The Obama Doctrine Defined, Commentary Magazine, July 2011. Chapter 17. The War on General Jones. "They're a bunch of Chicago thugs," Diane Jones, wife of General James Jones, speaking about Barack Obama's inner circle. Diane Jones had reason to be bitter. No one in the Obama White House had a more distinguished record of service to his country than her husband, James Logan Jones, Jr., The 6'4", plain-spoken, retired 4-star Marine Corps general was a decorated combat veteran of the Vietnam War, a former commandant of the Marine Corps, the first Marine Corps general to serve as supreme Allied commander in Europe, and a trusted military advisor to both Democratic and Republican presidents. And yet, within months of being appointed as Obama's first national security advisor, Jones became the victim of a snarky whispering campaign by White House aides, who spread word in the media that he was so detached from his job that he bicycled home to McLean, Virginia, for lunch and left work early. As a rule, Jones followed John Wayne's advice in She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. Never apologize, never explain. It's a sign of weakness. But things became so nasty in the West Wing that, less than 4 months into his tenure, he took the unusual step of defending himself in the press. "I'm here by 7 o'clock in the morning and I go home at 7:30 at night. That's a fairly reasonable day if you're properly organized." "There is a generational thing here," continued Jones, who at age 65 was some 20 years older than most of his staff. "There is a process thing here. I'm used to staffs, and I'm used to certain order. I'm used to people having certain roles. And so there's a very natural adjustment period. When I first went into the Oval Office, I didn't expect 6 other people from the National Security Council to go with me." Asked by a New York Times reporter about the behavior of young Obama officials who prided themselves on staying at the White House until late at night, Jones snapped, "Congratulations. To me, that means you're not organized." The late Richard Holbrooke, the most talented diplomat of his generation and Obama's representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan, respected Jones. In response to charges that Jones delegated too much responsibility to his subordinates, Holbrooke pointed out that, as a Marine, Jones believes in team building and had produced a sophisticated, multi-layer decision structure at the National Security Council that did not exist before. Holbrooke didn't suffer fools or amateurs gladly, and as far as he was concerned, hiring someone as mature and experienced as Jim Jones, and then not using him properly, displayed a lack of executive sense on the part of Obama. But Holbrooke's defense of Jones fell on deaf ears. Holbrooke had been a Hillary Clinton loyalist during the primary campaign, and, like Jones, he was treated as an outsider by the inbred clack of Obamans. Jones's brutal turf fights with Obama's inner circle were chronicled in Bob Woodward's book, Obama's Wars, for which Jones was a major source. The general complained to Woodward that the political team Obama had imported from Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, David Axelrod, Valerie Jarrett, and Robert Gibbs, made it virtually impossible for him to do his job. The Chicagoans even went so far as to block his access to the president. He described them to Woodward as waterbugs, the Politburo, and the Mafia. A clash of personalities was only part of Jones's problems. For all of Obama's talk about being open-minded and willing to listen to competing ideas, he was only comfortable with people who shared his view of America as a less predominant power in a multipolar world. Though a registered Democrat, Jones was non-ideological. He was neither a hawk nor a prophet of American doom. He was a warrior diplomat, in the tradition of Generals George C. Marshall and Maxwell Taylor, and the sorry saga of his tenure in the White House said volumes about how Barack Obama conducted America's foreign policy. Jones hardly knew Obama when he was appointed to head the National Security Council. In fact, the two men had met only twice. The first time was in 2005, when then-Senator Obama's foreign policy aide, Mark Lippert, arranged a meeting between the two men. Obama and Jones met again in the fall of 2008, when President-elect Obama asked Jones to become his chief national security advisor. Despite his low-key manner and the deference he showed to the young, inexperienced president, Jones was never able to bond with Obama the way his predecessors in the NSC job, Condoleezza Rice and Stephen Hadley, had bonded with George W. Bush. There were signs from the beginning that Jones's calm, systematic approach to problems did not fit the frenetic, highly politicized atmosphere in the Obama White House. That lesson was brought home to Jones when he was asked to phone Marine General Anthony Zinni, the former commander of Central Command and a friend of 30 years, and offer him a key job in the new administration. Jones asked if I would be willing to serve as ambassador to Iraq or in one of the envoy jobs on the Middle East peace process, Zinni recalled. I said yes. Then, right after the inauguration, Jones called and said, "We talked to the Secretary of State and everybody would like to offer you the Iraq job." I said yes. The Vice President called and congratulated me. The next thing Zinni knew, he was asked to meet with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in her office at the State Department. When he showed up, Clinton introduced him to Deputy Secretary of State James Steinberg and Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs William Burns. "She asked me my views on Iraq," Zinni said. "She said to Burns and Steinberg, 'We've got to move quickly. Ambassador Ryan Crocker is leaving Iraq. We've got to get someone in there and get the paperwork done and hearings. Lots to do to get ready to go.'" Zinni expected to get a call the next day, and when he didn't, he phoned Undersecretary Bill Burns. "To make a long story short, I kept getting blown off all week," Zinni said. "Meanwhile, I was rushing to put my personal things in order. I was beginning to set up to resign from boards and put my financial house in order, kiss my wife goodbye. And nothing happened. Finally, nobody was telling me anything. I called Jones several times. I finally got through late in the evening. I asked Jones, 'What's going on?' And Jones said, 'We decided on Chris Hill.' I said, 'No one told me. If I hadn't called you, I'd have read about it in the Washington Post.' And Jones said, 'I didn't know.'" Jones was mortified by the way the Obama White House had treated his old friend and fellow Marine. As things turned out, it was only the first of many humiliations he suffered while working with Barack Obama. Despite his considerable prestige, Jones was not permitted to pick his own staff. What's more, he was rarely allowed to see the president alone. When he went to the Oval Office, he was usually accompanied by a phalanx of aides, including three political operatives who had played key roles in Obama's 2008 presidential campaign: Jones's chief of staff, Mark Lippert, his deputy, Tom Donilon, who had coached Obama for his debates against John McCain, and Dennis McDonough, the director of strategic communications. At times, this group was expanded to include Hillary Clinton, Valerie Jarrett, David Axelrod, Rahm Emanuel, and on rare occasions, Michelle Obama. Most of the attendees were not foreign policy experts. However, that didn't stop people like Valerie Jarrett from expressing opinions on matters about which they knew little or nothing. Making Jones part of a large and diffuse group signaled to everyone in Washington that he didn't have Obama's ear on foreign policy. His influence was further diminished by the way Obama conducted meetings on foreign policy. He liked to do most of the talking. Others in the room, including Jones, were there to listen and agree, even on military matters, like the deployment of aircraft carrier groups. Leslie Gelb, the former president of the Council on Foreign Relations, told me that no president had taken more personal control over foreign policy than Obama. "This is an Obama-centric decision-making operation. In other administrations, a lot of decisions were made below the presidential level. But Obama shapes most policies. He takes pen to paper and writes decision papers. Usually, presidents have other things to do than sit down and write a document that takes an inordinate amount of time. But Obama makes the calls on most every subject and with a degree of personal intensity." Both in the Oval Office and at National Security Council meetings in the Situation Room, Obama seemed to pass quickly over Jones in favor of his deputy, Tom Donilon. Understandably enough, this annoyed Jones. He had little use for Donilon, a Democratic Party insider who had worked as an aide for Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale, and was a former Washington lobbyist and executive at Fannie Mae. Jones was particularly annoyed by Donlan's habit of making derogatory remarks about American military commanders in Iraq and Afghanistan.